Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
These days, I can do anything from my phone. Book a vacation, order a meal from a five-star restaurant, buy and trade stocks. But maybe the most amazing thing I can do is make my dirty laundry disappear and then reappear perfectly washed and folded. I have Rinse to thank for that. I just schedule a pickup in the Rinse app or at rinse.com. A Rinse valet comes to get my clothes, and before I know it, they're back, crisply folded and ready to wear. They even do dry cleaning, which is returned hanging in a nice Rinse garment bag. And with Rinse, my satisfaction is guaranteed. If for any reason I'm not happy, they'll re-clean my clothes for free. Best of all, Rinse saves me tons of time each week. That's time I get to do something I love versus something I have to do. So if you want to save loads of time by not doing loads of laundry, remember, there's an app for that. Rinse. Sign up now and get $20 off your first order at rinse.com. That's RINSE.com.
Hey, everybody, this is Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It's always a treat to be with you in the house, as they say. I'm so glad you guys could download me today. Don't forget to do that often as you can. I'm, of course, at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts on. And certainly you can follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Always a treat when you do that. And don't forget to do that little thing called like. You know, people just like to be liked. Well, I'm no different. Just go ahead and like me now so we can get it over with. Today we thought we'd have a different kind of conversation. You know, as we like to say, we mix it up quite a bit here on the Michael Steele Podcast. And so the way this kid, our guest, came about is actually kind of serendipitous and just typically the way the Twitter world works. So I had sent out a tweet on Tucker, when Tucker Carlson folks, particularly money guys inside the GOP, talk about running Tucker Carlson for president. And I just tweeted out, these people must be on low-grade crack because I don't know what the hell they're thinking. But anyway, it was a fun tweet. And Lisa Mansourian tweeted back to me, responded, you know, that she liked me. She was very kind in her compliment. But then she says, you must, in all caps, interview Jeremy Levin. It's Levin, right? Levin?
Levine.
Yep. Jeremy Levine, because I always get Levine. I've got Levin, I got Levine, and now I have Levine. Jeremy Levine, he's a brilliant young whippersnapper. Well, you had me at whippersnapper. Of course, I got to talk to whippersnappers, right? So Jeremy then responded, it'd be an honor to be on your podcast. And I responded back, you bet, you're on. So I reached out to Jeremy. And he agreed to come on. And Jeremy Levine is an adjunct instructor at NYU School of Professional Studies and has taught a variety of political science, economics, sociology, business, math, and public administration courses. His brother is sharp. at undergraduate and graduate level, at universities such as Princeton, Pace, the College of New Jersey, Montclair State University, and the list goes on. He holds a master's degree in public policy and international affairs. I have a degree from Hopkins in international relations, so we kindred spirits there, from William Patterson University. Welcome to the podcast, Professor. Good to have you.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I appreciate, you know, having a little fun on Twitter with you and your response in that tweet series. And I figured, well, you know, there must be something about Jeremy that folks out there say, I got to talk to this guy. So I'm glad you could make it on. So give me a little bit of what you're doing. And this has got to have been a very different environment for you as a professor. Certainly at the beginning of COVID-19, which was, you know, in the middle of the second semester and the end of the second semester school year. How have you coped in terms of keeping your students engaged and trying to move the academic process along?
It's been challenging at times. It's definitely not the same as being in a classroom per se, but fortunately some of my classes like economics, sociology, political science, a lot of them are discussion based.
Right.
I mean, yes, with economics, I can use like the whiteboard on Zoom and draw like supply and demand, but fortunately a lot of them are discussion based. So I guess have an easier time than say like a biology professor who needs like a lab,
right,
to do a lot of that work. Actually, I would also say the challenges weren't so much this past semester. It's the upcoming semester because the universities, many of them are still scrambling, trying to figure out if I'm going to be in person, if I'm going to be online.
Right.
Is it a combination? Do you start early? Do you get out early? So it's as challenging as it was during like the height of the pandemic here in New Jersey and New York. It's going to be more challenging now going forward just because I don't even know what I'm doing.
Right. Yeah. And that's not a good thing when the professor says, I have no idea what I'm doing here. How do you see that playing out, though? I mean, because you're right. Right now it's a patchwork across the country. So, you know, universities are having to make decisions because, you know, they have a little bit more of an advantage than a high school or elementary school because they don't have to be necessarily close-quartered. But there's still big decisions to be made about whether you bring students back to campus and when you do and if you do, what that means. How does that look for you in the classroom? No indication yet of what your academic, the fall academic schedule is going to look like. So you're planning sort of being there, not being there, online, offline, a hybrid. How's that going? It's because, look, you're technically, what, 3 weeks out from when the school season really kind of starts up again, you know, the beginning of August. Where are you finding you and your colleagues at this point in the planning process for the fall?
I'm going to plan for in-person just because if I have to go online, it's much easier to adjust going that way. But it's a good question. So that's just what I'm doing, but it is a good question. Some of the department chairs have reached out and said, does anybody have preferences? Some of them have insisted being on in person. I told my chairs, whatever you want. Like if I don't have to drive an hour and a half to the college in New Jersey or commute from New Jersey into New York, I won't personally be that upset during the middle of a pandemic. So I told them whatever, but it's challenging because even like there are some advantages, like you said, like it's not like a high school, but some of the concerns have been there's only like 10 or 15 minutes usually between classes in a particular classroom of a building. So how do you disinfect classrooms? Who disinfects? Some of them said the professors should, which I really don't want to do.
Right.
Because then I would have to get to my next class, which depending on the university could be like 15, 20 minutes apart on a different part of the campus. So it's like little things like that. And then also I think the issue is with dorming. I remember my freshman year of college, there was the flu, there was something called a neurovirus, and I, who never get sick or infections, got ringworm on my arm from the community bathrooms in a shower. So I would only imagine the coronavirus in the dorms can spread probably very quickly, and then if you bring that into the classroom. But the universities don't want to lose their room and board money. A lot of them need it.
Well, and then that raises a really big financial question / burden for our universities across the country. In that vein, how have your colleagues assessed the nature of the response at the federal and state level to coronavirus, largely speaking, but then more narrowly focused because you have the president and those in the administration, our Secretary of Education, for example, pushing that schools reopen. And it seems to be a push without real regard to some of the concerns that you've raised, just from a very practical level. You're talking about one professor in a set of classrooms at maybe three or four universities as you teach over the course of the semester. And then you multiply that, know, manifold.
Right.
How have academicians sort of looked at this, trying not to get into the politics and trying to just do your thing as, you know, professors, to provide the service of education to students? But you got to look at it and go, do you people have a clue what the hell y'all doing, or how have you guys assessed it?
I guess from the state and federal perspectives, it's very different, at least in New Jersey.
Right.
Phil Murphy's been pretty good mm-hmm. with this, taking it very seriously from the get-go, shutting everything down. I felt bad for the restaurant owners in the area because there was a plan to open them, and then he shut that down very suddenly.
Right.
So if you were like a restaurant owner stocking up on food, you got hurt pretty bad there. He's been pretty good with the universities. Early on in the pandemic, there was something where they were going to keep the libraries open, and a lot of the librarians were concerned on the campus, and then Phil Murphy came in and kind of shut it down. So he's been pretty good, and I think he's almost been following Cuomo's lead. The two of them together
mm-hmm.
have been pretty good with the universities. If the federal response was better, I think myself and my colleagues would feel a lot better about potentially going back into a classroom for a period of time.
Right.
Just think, because the federal response has been such a mess, I don't personally think they really care about my well-being or my colleagues with what happens.
No, I don't think so.
No. So I think that's the concern. So some of the universities now, they're trying to get out by Thanksgiving. So they're trying to start a week early, cancel fall break, get out by Thanksgiving. So that way you kind of beat the winter. And when things can really maybe escalate, when the weather gets colder on top of the flu season. So that's one of the things they're trying to do, because nobody's really optimistic. And when you have like Harvard and some of the top schools in the country all just going online, because they have all the medical schools and everything. So when
right.
they're going online, it's something that I noticed
right.
as well. But it's also, there's a little bit of a balancing act to it, because like it's going to look bad if a very small school in New Jersey pushes to stay open when Harvard's online, but that small school doesn't have the endowments that Harvard has.
Right.
So a lot of balancing here.
You've got an economic need at a small school that a Harvard does not have. It can tap into a $50 billion endowment or whatever crazy number
something
it is.
Like, yeah.
And not. I mean, they think twice about it, obviously, but not to the same degree that a smaller university that, as you mentioned earlier, has to rely on the book fees and the the room and board fees, et cetera, in addition to tuition. So Professor, I'm going to have you speak as Professor of the United States. You have a particular job that has just been created inside the sort of innocuous administration, not the current administration, but in this world. We're on Earth 17 right now. So you're the professor that the administration has tapped into designing a strategy, because this is part of what you do. It's part of what you teach when you're looking at sociology and business and economics and how all these things, all of these tools are used in the real world. So you've been tapped to design a recovery strategy for universities and colleges across the country, particularly our community colleges as well. How would you set about setting up a recovery plan for the university systems across the country in light of what you know universities are considering going into the fall? Would you create sort of a hybrid system? Would you decentralize the process and to say, y'all do what you think you need to do best? How would you see structuring something very much in the Dr. Fauci kind of way of looking at the thing holistically and coming up with a strategy that, can be implemented?
If you have to be on the campus, if you have to be in a bio lab or a chemistry lab or something like that, I would say that's okay. And I think you can probably do that, and you can space out how many students are in a lab at one time
right.
and then how much time you need in between to switch it. If you don't have to be on campus to teach your class, like as much as it's probably easier for me to have a board in a classroom to do economics, I can do it online. I would really strongly advise doing online or in a hybrid format where maybe no more than half the classes at a time are on campus. Maybe you could do half the classes, you start like half the classes are on campus to start the semester and then it flips the other half. But I would really stress online and hybrid. And I guess the problem with that, I acknowledge, is you're going to lose, the university can lose a lot of money doing it that way. Mm-hmm. I would say then, not that I usually push for big government to do all these things, but like, if you've been bailing out Wall Street through the years, maybe you could throw some of the universities bone that need the money to offset.
There's a thought.
Offset, but I know with this administration and Senate, that's not going to happen. So I would, you got to give them flexibility, but I would strongly push online and hybrid unless you absolutely, it's absolutely essential for you to be on a campus.
And a lot of that's going to be contingent on the prospect of having some type of, at least for the first semester or the first quarter and a half, if you're on a quarter system, where you know you can anticipate getting a vaccination sometime in the first quarter of next year, you know, early 2021. So that kind of strategy, at least to me, the way you describe it, makes sense. It's sort of, you take a little bit of hit in the financial pocket, but at least you can, recoup some of that. You know, it's going to be a dance. You're not going to be able to charge the full freight for room and board and all that other stuff, for example, particularly if the kid's at home at mom and dad, you know.
Right. And I think also, like, I don't have kids, but if I had a college student who was at the University of Miami right now, if I live in New Jersey, you're not going.
Right.
Like, you have to, I would then give a student like that the option to stay online so that way they don't transfer out.
Right. Right.
So I think that's where you said, like, take a little bit of a hit now, but like, it might be better in the long run. Like, give the students options now, so that way they don't up and leave to a school that might treat them a little better.
Well, it's good to get a perspective from someone, particularly in the academic space right now, where as we begin as a country to turn towards looking at academia and how they're positioned and are going to be repositioned going into the fall academic year. To talk to someone who's at least, you know, have to think about this stuff and plan for it in terms of the classroom. And that's why I appreciate having you on, because I like to get real folks involved in the conversation, because a lot of time, you know, they bring on all these people who are talking in terms of, you know, theories and concepts. And guys like you are actually having to talk to students and figure out how to teach them and how to have them learn and, you know, have that flow and exchange of ideas and information actually work. You don't get involved in the conversation. They don't bring you in. So it's a real pleasure having you here for that conversation. We're going to take a quick break with the good professor. When we come back, we're going to put him to the test a little bit on what it is he does best, which, from what I understand, poli sci, economics, sociology, business. Yeah, he's pretty good. We're talking with the good professor Jeremy Levine, adjunct instructor at NYU School of Professional Studies. We'll have more with Jeremy when we come right back.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. I'm Michael Steele, and we're, like I said, having a conversation with adjunct professor Jeremy Levine at NYU School of Professional Studies. But he also, in addition to NYU, you teach around. I got the impression from what you were saying before, you're at several universities in what you do, professor?
Yes, I'm at multiple universities in New Jersey and Manhattan, and then depending on the school, it's the area subject that I teach. And as the adjunct life, you just got it. The more classes I teach, the more money I make, so I just take what I get.
Brothers figured out how to make it work. That's how you do it, man. It's just like, okay, no, I can teach that, and I can teach this. Oh, and that too? And over
and it helps because my master's, as you said, is public policy and international affairs, and my bachelor's was finance. So I have like a little bit of business, a little bit of social sciences, so I kind of bring it together.
Well, it's excellent. It's just good to have real people in the conversation, right? Because you know you're one of these real guys out here, and you're engaged at a time of coronavirus and a faltering economy. Yes, it's rising for a lot of people who've got a lot of stuff in the market, but for folks who are living paycheck to paycheck and haven't been paid in 2-3 months, folks, it's hard out there. It's really hard. And Jeremy is the professor to the students whose parents and students themselves, in many cases, have fallen on those hard economic rocks. And you're also looking at a time, Jeremy, of social upheaval, civil unrest, certainly in the space regarding the relationship of the police to African-American community and how all of that plays together. As a professor who works in political science, economics, and sociology, how do you see this moment? How would you, if you're writing the early history of this moment, how would you do that? How would you describe it? How would you define it for a generation that's going to come afterwards and at least look at this early moment? You know, like that archaeologist who cracks that rock that sort of gives, oh yeah, this is the first line I see, you know, there was a you know, it was a tornado or a great flood or whatever, that sort of tells what happened in that moment. How would you define this moment right now?
I would say, to give it like a snapshot, like headline, like whether you agree with what the people are marching for or fighting for or not, it's almost like an awakening has occurred. Like people have started to pay attention to the real world and what's going on more than when I was in high school and college. I remember, like, I was always one who read the news. Like, I played sports. I had a lot of friends, but I always read newspapers. I always paid attention to current events. And, like, I was, like, one of my few friends who ever did. Same thing in college when I used to intern in legislative offices. Like, nobody even bothered to ask, like, what I did friend-wise. But it's very different now. Over the last few years, it was building, and it's just completely exploded now, where students, young people are really paying attention. And so where I teach at Pace University in Manhattan is right next to the Brooklyn Bridge, where a lot of the chaos in New York City happened. So my classes are going to be really interesting now with some of the discussions, because we're going to hit on many of these topics. And I welcome students who disagree. I think it makes the class more entertaining and everything. But I think it's students have woken up. People are paying attention. I don't know if it's because Trump put a little fear in them. I've had a lot of students the last few years who are like genuinely afraid of what's going on.
Yeah, but will they vote? I mean, let's just break it down. I get. So how do you as a social scientist emphasize to someone, certainly a social scientist with a poli-sci, political science background as well? So you know the value of this republic and the democratic principles we espouse, and certainly the importance of the constitutional ideas we set out there, especially voting, and yet they don't fully participate. Yeah, they'll go protest and they'll scream and they'll shout and they'll get all upset and mad. But then come election day, did you vote? Oh man, yeah, I totally forgot. Or yeah, I had something else to do. Or yeah, I just figured, you know, the other team is going to win anyway. So how do you as a professor in this space, particularly given everything you've just said and what you know of your students, how do you engage them to get them to appreciate, you know, it ain't done until you actually vote? That's when you put a stamp on all your activism.
That is very true. And even in the Democratic primary, we saw like very low young voter turnout compared to the older generations of Americans, which was disappointing given everything that's gone on in the last few years. Some of the things that I stress to them is I don't care who you vote for. I don't care what party you're about, but you need to make your voice heard. If you pay attention enough, you will see that there are people who don't want you to vote, people who discourage you from voting. Ask them why they don't want you to vote. If there wasn't power behind your vote, that people wouldn't care if you voted or not.
That's true.
And the more people who come together and vote, the stronger that voice and the stronger that impact becomes. And then I also throw into them, well, if you're not going to vote, then do you have the right then to complain about what's going on, whether it's at the local level of government, state level, federal level, whatever, if you didn't actually try to make your voice heard in the ballot box? Like if you didn't vote in 2016, do you have a right then to complain about what's going on? Or if you didn't vote for your mayor of your town or city, do you have a right then to complain if the mayor gives extra money to the police and all these different things? Right. So you're absolutely right. Unless you go out and vote, none of it matters. And when I've tried to use like social media to express that, a couple people have said, well, this isn't about voting. This is about whatever it is. And people have given me different things. And I said, it has to be about voting.
Dude, if that's your response, this is, you know, this isn't about voting. Everything in this country is about voting.
Because for people who were protesting the police and were telling me, well, it's not about voting. Well, then, don't you think you'd have an easier time or your voice would be heard if, say, like a different attorney general was listening to you?
Well, not even attorney general, professor. I mean, who do you think appoints the police? If the police chief isn't run for the office, a sheriff or whatever, who do you think appoints them? The person you voted for mayor the city or the county council or the city council. I mean, come on, folks. You cannot sit there and tell me, oh, this has nothing to do with voting.
Oh, yeah. No, so that's what I stress at. So even though there has been positive change, like change I never thought I would see, like the Confederate symbol coming off the Mississippi flag and the Confederate flag not being welcomed at NASCAR events anymore, things I never thought I would see, there's more work to be done. And unless you're willing to go out and vote, that work cannot be done. Because the people who don't want you to vote will always show up to vote and make sure it's as difficult as possible for you.
So with that in mind, with that is sort of the backdrop and sort of really what will be the setup for going into classrooms this fall, whether they're live or virtual, do you believe that, given where we are in this current crisis and the conditions that have been sort of created by the president, and I'm not looking for a partisan answer because I know you know, unlike a lot of the folks on my side, I don't assume every professor who teaches at a university is some left wing, Marxist ideologue.
When I interned in high school and college, all my work was for the Republican Party. Actually,
so you learned the hard way. So given where we are and all of that, do you think the president still has a good chance of winning re-election this November?
No, I don't. Okay. I know I didn't think he would win in 2016. So like, I guess in theory I could be wrong again. But I don't see the path for him to win. I don't understand how he thought just essentially letting the virus wash over this entire country was like good for his reelection chances. I don't get his response. I'm not a medical expert by any stretch, but I do have questions about him neurologically when he slurs, he has awkward movements. I'm not even sure he's well. I don't think he's well if I had to make a guess. But I think it helps having on the other side a candidate who can win over people like myself who were a part of the Republican Party and said like, okay, I don't want to be part of this Trump thing. And then on the other side, people who would never vote for Trump ever. So even like if Biden was to win and that coalition falls apart and everybody then fight, like I don't expect AOC and the Lincoln Project to vote for the same presidential candidate a few times. But that's what I guess Biden has been able to do kind of.
Right,
form
you know,
that
they'll do it at least once.
They'll do it at least once. Exactly. And I think that will be enough. And even like I don't know if Trump will lose Texas. But just the fact that it's competitive to me is a bad sign. Even some of the other, I think like Arkansas at one point was competitive. Like there's just too many states that he should win easily.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at those polls and I'm like, if he can't win Texas, he's not going to win Florida or he's not going to win Wisconsin. Like,
right.
I haven't seen this really anything numbers wise that's promising for him. And I don't even see a strategy from his end from how to turn it around. And you can't tell Americans, well, just get numb to people dying from the virus.
Right.
That's not. And like the Republican Party typically had like an older demographic voting wise, especially in certain states. And just telling old people to die for the sake of the economy of your grandchildren. Well, that's not a re-election strategy either. So I don't see the strategy and I don't see the numbers.
So I would agree with that analysis, and I think it is backed up by the polling that's out now, even though I put a big ass asterisk on that, folks. As you know, those of you who listen to the podcast, I do not buy into national polling at this stage in a presidential election because A national poll doesn't tell you what's actually happening on a state-by-state basis, and particularly in some of the battleground states. But the interesting part, Professor, about this time relative to the national polling is that as opposed to being a either a lagging indicator or not an indicator at all, as we saw in 2016, my suspicion is that voters are making up their minds a lot sooner on who they want to vote for. And consequently, those that national polling is not a lagging indicator, but almost a leading indicator of where people are projecting. In other words, usually in a national polling in the summer, you kind of laugh. If you're a guy like me, you look at these numbers and you go, okay, yeah, you're going to bank your election on that, baby.
There's a lot of time between that and November.
Right, just pay me my fee up front and I'm just going to go to the beach for the remainder of the campaign because, dude, you're not winning. But the reality of it is what you're seeing right now, I think, is something a little bit different. And I'd be curious as to what you think sociology of this is coupled with the politics of it in terms of how people are kind of getting a sense of where they want to go with this election, because the numbers have been consistent for an extended period of time. They're not the mad fluctuations where, you know, you're talking everything's within the margin of error. You know, you're up one day by six, you're down the next day by three, et cetera, you know, kind of polling. Joe Biden has had for now going on a month a consistent and growing expansion of his electoral base from 6-7 to now 11-12 points over Donald Trump. What do you think that is? And does it kind of give you a sense, at least some small indication of how the voters are feeling, irrespective of what you may think of a national poll at this point?
Yeah, well, I think if you didn't like Trump in 2016, I don't think you're going to like him much more in 2020. Because I remember a lot of people said, a lot of people I know who voted for him said, well, once he gets in office, he'll settle down, calm down, surround himself with the experts and just do what he's told. And that hasn't happened. And I think that was a wake up call for some people. I think people are very angry. I think people are scared. I've had students tell me that all the time. And usually I do promise that things will get better. That was before the pandemic. Now it's a different ballgame now that that pandemic kicked in. And I tell people there's cycles all the time. One party has majorities, then it's the other, and it fluctuates back and forth. But I think a lot of people have already made up their mind. I mean, there's been so much craziness and scandals and an impeachment over the last 4 years. If you haven't made up your mind by now, I don't know what it would take. I almost think you're just not going to vote. That's kind of where I'm at with it, and that's kind of what I'm seeing with it. The other thing too is I think people are afraid that he's going to try to play the Nixon. And every once in a while, Trump sends out like the silent majority tweet and all that. But when things really blew up in 1968, from Vietnam to the protests outside the DNC in Chicago, Nixon wasn't the incumbent. These kinds of crises historically usually favor the person not already in power.
Right.
So Trump can't claim, he's got to ask the voters to give him a chance to get it under control. Whereas Biden's like, look, everything's spiraling out of control under the other guy. Let me take care of it. Usually that message is easier to sell than give me a second chance to kind of clean things up. And that's why he's not Nixon. And then even Nixon with the silent majority, Virginia within a few years went from red to blue. I mean, there's been one election after the next that Republicans really should have won, or that Trump did well in 2016 in a particular district that the Democrats have pulled wins really almost out of thin air and out of surprise. So if there's a silent majority, it hasn't showed up. The House flipped to blue in 2018. So I just think he's in trouble because I don't think he can play the Nixon card. I don't think this is 88 where Bush is going to, you know, catch up to Dukakis.
Right.
In 88, because I just think George H.W. Bush is more competent for starters than Trump is as well, more disciplined. And I just think that's why Biden is favored here, because this didn't happen under his watch. You can't. When Trump tries to say, well, it's Obama and Biden's fault because there's no testing, but the virus didn't exist then. So right. There's no running from this. You can't, like when he's done historically, declare bankruptcy, screw over the creditors and start over. That's not how the presidency works. And that's why all this run the country like a business. It's not the best analogy, because you just fundamentally can't do it.
How will you teach on the economy this fall? How do you see that playing a factor? We know COVID-19 is going to play a factor in the voters' mind. Certainly for a certain segment of the population, the George Floyd murder and the civic unrest that flowed from that were going to play a factor. But the economy is the one thing that kind of, certainly from the Republican leadership point of view, they were looking to go into November, you know, talking about jobs up, Wall Street up, taxes down, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
That's now changed. How do you teach, how will you be teaching your students this fall about this economic climate we're in, given the impact primarily COVID-19 has had on all of this?
As I've been telling my students, unless you get the pandemic under control, the economy is not going to bounce back and come back. You can't. There's numerous companies have closed down. They've gone bankrupt. Hertz, Neiman Marcus. So all these people who lost their jobs because of the pandemic now don't have jobs to go back to. I was reading in Georgia when the governor tried to open things up. It was one of those like hatchet axe throwing places. And they tried opening for a weekend, and I think two people showed up the entire weekend because people are scared. So you have businesses closing, so people are not going to have the jobs that they once had. I'm not in a rush. Like if New Jersey was to say, okay, let's open up the bars for a few hours, I'm not jumping even at 28 years old to go to a club right now. I don't know who I'm around or where they've been. So I think on the consumer side, with the demand side, people are hesitant. Spend money and get out there. And I think the supply side, the businesses, you don't know what the climate's like. You can't prepare, right? So like even when you, like the restaurants thought they were going to be able to open, and now Murphy said no. Well, if you were stocking up on food and supplies, you just lost a lot of money because now you can't sell it unless you do like to go, if that even sells all of it. So I just think until you get the pandemic under control, it's not, you just can't fix this country economically. It's not an economic or a financial crisis. Right. It's a health crisis that's impacting the economy. So the Fed, you can do whatever, you know, QE, inject whatever you want into the economy, into the banks. But until there's confidence on the consumer end and businesses are told it's safe to operate, this is something that's going to drag on for a while. So I know early on, like when the year started, unemployment was low. So that's what the Republicans are going to try to do. We lowered your taxes. The economy's great. The economy's not great. And I've been arguing that the market's overheated and probably going to come down. That if you're using the Dow Jones right now as your indicator that everything's fine, that's a fool's move. Because I was arguing before the pandemic it was overheated. Now I think it really is, because there's nothing on the ground on Main Street that's driving that up. Whether it's just going up because of the Fed's actions, or whether just a lot of wealthy people driving up certain stock prices, it's not the indicator to use right now. And again, until the health pandemic comes back, you're not going to have normal schools. It's more than the economy. You're not going to have normal schools. You're not going to have normal anything. You can tell people to go back into schools all you want. People don't feel safe. You can tell people to go spend money wherever. They don't feel safe. I'm not rushing to go to a mall right now, and even with the pandemic somewhat under control in Jersey. Mm-hmm. So if that's what they're banking on, that people are just going to become numb to this and everything can just return back to normal. I've seen some personalities like Britt Hume and Tomi Lahren and others like, let's just open everything up, go back to normal, and it'll all be fine. That's not how a virus works.
No, it's not how a virus works at all. In fact, I was when you were talking about at 28, you don't plan to go to the bars. I was like, yeah, I can see you showing up now with your mask on and your rubber gloves and the, you know, hand sanitizer, saying, "Hey, baby, what's your sign?"
Exactly. It's not the best like first impression kind of look to a woman. No, not a-
it doesn't work like that. No, it doesn't work like that. Oh, I love it, man. This has been a real treat having you on. Professor Jeremy Levine, who is the adjunct instructor, professor at NYU School of Professional Studies, and also teaching at Pace University, the College of New Jersey, Montclair State University, Fairleigh Dickinson University, among many others. It's such a pleasure having you on, giving us a street level view of what you know, parents are concerned about going into this upcoming academic year, and how universities like the ones you teach at are trying to make it all work and fit and still provide quality education for students this fall. So really appreciate you being a part of the front line out there, my man. I know it's not easy, but we're grateful that you're there.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I tell people, like, we're all going to get through this eventually. We have to work together, wear the mask. No one likes wearing a mask, but like, we got to do what we got to do to get through this.
Yes, I could not agree more. And that is the word of the day from the professor. So y'all take heed, because there will be a test on Tuesday, and we don't need y'all failing because you didn't bring a mask. All right. So make sure everybody's prepared and ready to go out and engage out there. Well, that does it for this episode, folks. I'm so glad you could be a part of the Michael Steele podcast. Certainly, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, you know, all the wonderful places that you get your podcasts. And certainly find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And check out the professor. Follow him on Twitter at JeremyLevine92. On Twitter, you can see him there. And for those students who will be lucky enough to have the professor in class this fall, you got a whippersnapper, just as our Twitter friend said. He's a good one, and it's such a pleasure having him on board today. All right, guys, that does it for now. Catch y'all next week. Stay safe. Be smart. Keep the damn mask on, all right? Wear it. Later.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.